Okay, well, I'd certainly like to join the rest of us here in wishing Mike a happy birthday. I want to apologize for not being able to come to the reception last night. Yesterday was my daughter's 6th birthday. for her, it's 10 times as important as yours, but and for me too, I'm afraid. But I'm trying to remember when I first met Mike, and I'm terrible with dates, but I think it was actually in the late 90s. But Mike had come down from Redmond, and I think already at that stage was thinking about possibly moving to Santa Barbara, and I guess we were traveling with Ike Schwong at that stage, at least he came down on that visit. And there were two things I noticed about Mike almost immediately. One was his infectious enthusiasm for pretty much everything, math, physics, and all other topics of intellectual thought. And the second thing I noticed is that I couldn't understand what he was talking about.
Very enthusiastic.
Yeah, but so there was this huge communication barrier between me and Mike. And I'm delighted to say that that communication barrier has come down a lot over the last 10 or 15 years, but no thanks to me. Really, thanks to Mike, who has made a tremendous effort to be able to communicate better with physicists such as myself and learn the language of physics and to learn physics. A number of anecdotes along those lines. During one of the recent, a couple of years ago, fires in Santa Barbara, Mike was kind enough to offer to put up my family and myself at his house, and which was very nice, and we slept a good night there, and came to breakfast in the morning, and Mike was there reading a book. I thought he'd be reading the paper, but he was reading a book. It turned out it was Atlan and Simons, which is a book on quantum kinetics metaphysics, and I guess, Mike, you had already worked your way through chapter 3, and you wanted to ask me about equation 3.17.2. So I was taking it really seriously. I was quite impressed. Right around that time, Mike decided to sit in on a many-body class that I was teaching at UCSB, and he shamed the graduate students, I will say, because he came to pretty much every lecture, as did they, in that class. And so I had better attendance in that class than I've had since. So Mike really has become a physicist, and just about a week ago we had a nice email exchange where Mike asked me about energy scales for fluxons in Long-Josephson junctions. And I knew about that topic at one point, but I'd sort of forgotten about it, so I read up on these things in Tinkham's book and wrote back kind of a long email, giving what I thought was the right answer, and also pointing out a subtlety with the masses of the fluxons. And Mike wrote back immediately and said, well, what about the ends of the fluxons interacting like at like two monopoles? Shouldn't there be a 1/r interaction in the energy between the fluxons? And you were right, Mike. And so this demonstrates the fact that now I'm learning a lot of physics from Mike, and I hope to continue to learn physics from Mike in the future. So thank you. Okay, what I want to talk about is quite far away from topological states. I want to talk about gapless interacting many-body electron systems, in particular the search for two-dimensional non-Fermi liquids for itinerant electrons. And so as I say, the goal here has been for quite a while to at least have some examples of non-Fermi liquid phases of strongly interacting electrons, to be able to construct them, to be able to analyze them, to maybe have Hamiltonians which exhibit them. So I'll tell you a little bit about wave functions for non-Fermi liquids using a parton construction, and then give you an example of a putative non-Fermi liquid, which we call a D-wave metal. I'll tell you the Hamiltonian, which we think has the D-wave metal as its ground state, and then talk about the solution of that Hamiltonian with DMRG. Before non-Fermi liquids, how about Fermi liquids? And before Fermi liquids, how about the free Fermi gas? So let me just remind something everybody knows, which the important thing is that the momentum distribution function is 1 inside the Fermi C, that is for wave vectors smaller than kF, and then jumps discontinuously to 0. And the volume inside the Fermi C is determined by the density of particles. And the beautiful thing about Fermi liquid theory is that when one turns on the interactions with a free Fermi gas, while the jump discontinuity is no longer unity in the momentum distribution function, this nevertheless is a jump discontinuity, and the wave vector, the Fermi surface that one deduces from that, still encompasses the total number of particles. So this is Luddington's theorem, which says the volume inside a Fermi surface is set by the total density of particles. Okay, so if we're looking for a non-Fermi liquid, we really want to look for a violation of that. Now, there's many different types of non-Fermi liquids one could imagine. One could have, for example, a singular but Fermi surface, but without a jump discontinuity that satisfies Luttinger's theorem. One could have a singular Fermi surface that violates Luttinger's theorem, has the wrong volume, for example. And one could have even more exotic things, at least in principle, perhaps, Fermi points or Fermi arcs.
Matthew, can I already ask you a question?
Yep.
As a matter of practice, how would you distinguish something like that from a finite temperature Fermi liquid?
You have to look at how it scales with temperature.
So it is a very tricky question.
It's a
quantitative question.
It's a quantitative question.
So I wanted to emphasize that point. In the end, it's a quantitative question because experiments will get finite temperature.
Yeah, I mean, but then you can vary it's hard, but you can vary the temperature, and if you're doing ARPAs, you can try to see whether it broadens with temperature or not.
Quantum oscillations
is good, yeah.
Yeah, that's the fun, the quantum oscillation comment. It's the same thing as temperature. At high temperature, Fermi liquid shows no quantum oscillation.
No, but the temperature dependence, though, gives you the Fermi function.
Correct, but it's a quantitative thing, is what I'm saying. You still have to use some theory and do fitting. And a couple of cases I looked at numerically, it's not so easy to distinguish. You really have to do a lot of work.
I mean, the plus is that, at least in many materials, the energy scales are not small, right? And so, they can be thousands of Kelvin, there can be tens of Kelvins or hundreds of Kelvin, and so, one can go to low temperatures and much lower than the characteristic energy scales if need be. But impurities are an effect, factor as well.
Yeah.
So
maybe it's not important, so I don't want to pull you off topic, but these three pictures that go with the singular Fermi arc, I don't really know what that is, and that's being implied. Does it maybe not matter?
It doesn't really matter.
No,
yeah. This is the loci of low energy excitations in momentum space. ARPA sees something that looks like that, at least at intermediate temperatures, in the pseudo-gap regime, in the high TC superconductors. But this is really just for motivation. Now, I'm mostly going to be in la-la land. That's theory land, but I think that's okay. So what about wave functions for two-dimensional fermions, since that's maybe the best route to try to access a non-Fermi liquid? Well, for a free Fermi gas, of course, as we all know, the wave function is just a Slater determinant, a product of two determinants for spinful electrons, spin up and spin down particles. What about wave function for an interacting Fermi liquid? Well, there's various different wave functions one can construct. One thing one can do is a Gutzwiller projection. This is common in the context of high TC superconductor, where one basically throws away configurations of the electron wave function in which spin up and spin down electrons are sitting on the same site. Alternatively, one could multiply by a Jastrow factor out front of the free fermion wave function, and which basically helps keep the particles apart from one another. This is commonly done when one's describing a system of helium-3, the Fermi liquid phase in helium-3. How about a non-Fermi liquid wave function? Well, there are perhaps many ways to try to access them, but what I want to describe is what would be called the parton approach, where one takes the electron operator and decomposes it, in this instance, into a charge B spinless boson and a spin 1/2 chargeless fermion, the spinon. And in a mean field theory, one treats the spinons and bosons as independent. One just assumes that the Hamiltonian is a sum of the Hamiltonian of the spinon and the Hamiltonian of the boson. If one has free fermions and bosons, one can write down the appropriate wave function, the wave function for the spinons and a wave function for the bosons. But now one has enlarged the Hilbert space. One has twice as many particles. One has basically broken each electron into two particles. And so that's no good. One has to fix up the mean field theory. And the way one can do that is just to glue together the fermionic and the bosonic partons. So one can essentially identify the coordinates of the boson with the coordinates of each of the electrons. That is, let the boson coordinates, capital R, get glued to the coordinates of the electrons, these little r's. One is making sure that every time one has a boson, one also has a spinon sitting on top of it, thereby recovering a projection back into the physical Hilbert space of electrons. So using this parton approach, one can recover Fermi and non-Fermi liquid wave functions. So we put the spinons in a filled Fermi C, just a Slater determinant product. Then to get a Fermi liquid, all we have to do is we have to multiply by the bosonic wave function where the bosons are in a Bose condensate. So one example of a Bose condensate wave function is precisely this Jastrow factor. And this gives us back the Fermi liquid, and one can see this at the operator level, that basically the electron operator, which is a product of the boson and the spinon operator, if we have a Bose condensation, we can replace the boson operator by its expectation value, which is just a constant, and the electron operator becomes up to a constant, multiplicative constant, equal to the spinon operator. What about a non-Fermi liquid? In order to get a non-Fermi liquid with this parton approach, we have to put the bosons into an uncondensed fluid, some sort of Bose metal state. And so here I've written wave function for a non-Fermi liquid is a free fermion wave function for spinons times the wave function for a Bose metal. Now, in the last couple of years, we've been able to construct wave functions for Bose metals. And in the context of the electron problem, that's fragmenting the charge sector. And the way we've been doing that is using a parton decomposition again, where now we break the boson into a product of two fermions. So we thereby arrive at an all-fermionic decomposition of the electron. The electron is written as a product of three fermions, the spinon, and two partons, D1 and D2, which describe the charge sector of the system. And then the appropriate Goodswiller wave function for the bosons is a product of the determinants of the D1 fermion and a determinant of the D2 fermion. Okay, so to get a wave function for a particular Bose metal, this D-wave Bose metal that we've played a lot with in the last few years, what one can do is one can take a product of two Fermi Cs where the determinants are elongated in the X or Y directions. So a wave function for a boson metal, a D-wave Bose metal, is a product of determinant of this X parton with a Fermi C elongated in the X direction and a Y parton with a Fermi C elongated in the Y direction. Okay, so that's fine and well writing down a wave function, and let me just pull it together there. So we then would have a putative wave function for an itinerant non-Fermi liquid phase, which we call a D-wave metal, where the D-wave metal wave function is basically a product of four determinants. The last two determinants are the spinons, which just fill up a Fermi C, spin up and spin down fermions in a Fermi C. And then we have the two determinants out front, which are the two partons, which together make the boson, and they have filled Fermi Cs elongated in the X and Y direction. Okay, so one can write down a wave function, and with a wave function, one doesn't have a theory, and that's the important thing. What one can do with a wave function, though, is use variation of Monte Carlo to extract equal time correlation functions. But one can write down almost any wave function one wants. So in order to be convincing in any setting at all, one really has to think about energetics and what kind of Hamiltonian might give a wave function as complicated as looking as that. So Hamiltonians, can we find a Hamiltonian with a D-wave metal ground state? Well, first, can we find a Hamiltonian with a D-wave Bose metal ground state? And that we have been able to do. We basically do this parton construction, as I described, and one has to introduce a U1 gauge field when one does that parton construction. And what one can do is take a strong coupling limit of that gauge field to obtain a Hamiltonian for bosons. And the key term in the Hamiltonian that one generates when these partons have anisotropic Fermi Cs is a ring exchange where two bosons on the opposite corners of a square hop simultaneously, as shown here. And one can understand the generation of this boson ring exchange by thinking in terms of partons. Basically, one takes each of the bosons and writes them in terms of two partons, a green parton and a blue parton. And then the green partons can hop preferentially in the x direction, so they hop as shown here, and the blue partons can hop preferentially in the y direction. And then one can reconstruct the boson after that hopping process to end up in the final configuration. So what one deduces is that if one has a wave function which corresponds to partons with strongly anisotropic Fermi Cs, elongated strongly in the x and y directions, the a possible Hamiltonian which will show that Bose metal ground state has a key element, which is this ring exchange. Okay, but I want to move to the D-wave metal, coming back to electrons, and do the same thing. So again, we can take the strong coupling limit of the parton gauge theory, and what we generate is a Hamiltonian, which I'm calling the TK ring Hamiltonian. So the way to think about this Hamiltonian is very much like the TJ Hamiltonian. In the TJ Hamiltonian, there's a no double occupancy constraint, so we have that here. The first term is the T term that's there in the TJ model. And the only thing that's different between this TK model and the TJ model is the form of this second interaction piece. In the TJ model, it's a spin-dot-spin interaction. Here, we're adding to the Hamiltonian a term which involves four sites around an elementary square, rather similar to the case for the bosons I just described, but now we're dealing with electrons with spin. We have to look at what the spin sector is doing. And so this term in the Hamiltonian, what it does is it takes an initial state in which the two electrons on site 1 and 3 are in a singlet. It destroys that state, and it creates a state in which the two electrons are now on sites 2 and 4 and in a singlet. So this term in the Hamiltonian, what it does is it destroys a singlet and rotates it and creates a singlet. So it's basically a singlet rotation term. And if this coefficient k is positive, it gets the singlets rotating around one another. So it's rather similar to the fractional quantum Hall effect, where the interaction between the electrons gets the electrons rotating around one another. But here the rotation involves a discrete process. And because of time reversal invariance, one has to end up with a singlet two-particle correlation, which is something like a DXY symmetry rather than a D plus ID symmetry, which one would have in the fractional quantum Hall effect. So for example, in Laughlin's nu equals 1/2 boson state, one has a ZI minus ZJ squared, which is DX squared minus Y squared plus IDXY. And it's the E cross B drift, which gets the electrons moving around each other. Here, this particular form of the Coulomb interaction gets, singlets of electrons moving around one another. And it's worth saying that if one starts with a system of electrons moving in the continuum with, ions in the background, that if one projects into a narrow band, one will generate all sorts of four-fermion interaction terms. One will certainly generate this term among others. And that's similar to what one has in the fractional quantum Hall effect. When one projects into the lowest Landau level, one generates these terms, which are basically interaction terms, which get particles moving around one another. Okay, so we've got a Hamiltonian. What about the phase diagram for this Hamiltonian? This Hamiltonian, just like any of these strongly correlated electron Hamiltonians, has a severe sign problem, and numerically it's very, very challenging, almost intractable. So the approach we're going to use is analyze this Hamiltonian on the two-leg ladder, where we can use collaborators can use DMRG. Now, as soon as we go onto the ladder, you might start worrying that, we're looking for non-Fermi liquids, but we know that if you put electrons on a one-dimensional system or two-leg ladder, that the Fermi liquid phase is immediately unstable to a Luttinger liquid phase. So how can we, say that we're going to find a non-Fermi liquid when generically one has something which is not a Fermi liquid? So just to remind you, indeed, then, electrons interacting in one dimension, the momentum distribution function no longer has a jump discontinuity like in a Fermi liquid, but has a singularity with some exponent here, the Luttinger liquid exponent. But an important point is that singularity defines a wave vector, call it the Fermi wave vector, which satisfies the Luttinger sum rule. So that is spinful or even spinless a Luttinger liquid in one dimension. While it's not a Fermi liquid, it has singularities, and at least for weak interactions, its dominant singularities will be at momenta which satisfy Luttinger's sum rule. If we consider two bands and electrons filling partially both bands, one will have in the bonding band a momentum distribution function which has some singularity. in the antibonding band, an electron momentum distribution function which has another singularity, and one can pull out these two Fermi wave vectors, kf0 and kf pi, and again, a Luttinger volume sum rule will still be satisfied. Okay, so a Luttinger liquid, or a weakly interacting Fermi liquid in 1D, or a Luttinger liquid, is kind of morally very close to a Luttinger liquid, very close to a Fermi liquid, excuse me. But what we're going to be looking for and finding, I believe, is what one might call a non-Luttinger liquid. It's going to be a Luttinger liquid which violates Luttinger's theorem. And there's too many Luttingers being thrown around, I'm afraid, but we don't have a better name for this thing. I mean, calling it a non-Luttinger liquid is not great. But let's look and see what kind of DMRG data we get. So here's the electron TK model on the two-leg ladder. There are just two dimensionless parameters, the ratio of K to T, the ring term to the kinetic energy, and the density. And we're going to just work so far at densities n equals 1/3, 1/3 of an electron per site. This is work in progress with a whole group of people. The DMRG work has predominantly been done by Hongchan Jiang, who's a postdoc at Q somewhere. Here he is. And a couple of my graduate students, Matt Block and Ryan Mishmash, have been involved. So far, this model has been attacked using exact ionization, DMRG, VMC, as well as bosonization of a one-dimensional gauge theory. So what does the data look like? So this is the DMRG data of the ground state energy versus the ratio of K over T, the ring term to the kinetic energy. And there are sort of three regimes, the regime where the energy is going up with ring exchange, the regime where it's more or less flat and independent, and a regime where it's coming down. And as we'll see, we believe that there are, in fact, three different phases in this model, and which are going to be Luttinger liquid, fully spin polarized, and this putative D-wave metal. So let's just first look in this this small ring exchange regime. If one looks at K equals zero, I should say that one's dealing with the infinite U Hubbard model and with just the kinetic energy. So looking over here, we can look at the electron momentum distribution function plotted versus momentum here, and what one sees are pretty sharp discontinuities. I mean, obviously we can't tell what the Luttinger exponent is here, but presumably there is one. But what we can do is count the area inside the Fermi C, and it indeed satisfies the Luttinger's volume theorem. So what we have here is a canonical single-band Luttinger liquid, spinful electrons in one dimension, which satisfies Luttinger's volume theorem. Well, now let's look in this intermediate regime. Well, what we find there, it turns out, is a spin-polarized electronic state. And for the particular model we're looking at, the non-interacting spin-polarized Fermi C is, in fact, the exact ground state in this regime of parameters. And Luttinger's theorem is satisfied. I mean, in this case, we've got electrons in the bonding band and electrons in the antibonding band. So we have two Fermi Cs. One can add up the sizes of those Fermi Cs to get the total number of electrons. So that Luttinger's volume theorem works. Finally, let's go over here where the ring exchange is larger than 1.25. And then we get something totally bizarre. We have an electron momentum distribution function like at least I've certainly never seen before. Right? It's got at qy equals pi in the antibonding band, it's actually non-monotonic. It's got this dip at zero momentum. In the qy equals zero, it has what looks like some sort of Fermi C with a jump, but the volume is small and is nowhere near the total number of electrons. Also, when one varies the parameters in the Hamiltonian makes this ring exchange term larger, the momentum distribution functions evolve, and the width of these singular regions get narrower. So we have very strange non-monotonic electron distribution functions, and there's no sign of Luttinger's volume theorem here. I mean, one doesn't know where to say the filled C is. So can we understand this momentum distribution function that comes from the DMRG in terms of the D-wave metal state on the two-leg ladder? Okay, so in order to do that, we want to employ the Parton construction. And so where we, again, break the electron into a product of three fermions, and the state that is going to do best energetically in the region of the D-wave metal corresponds to filling the bonding and antibonding band of this DX fermion partially, and for the DY fermion and for the spinon, just filling the lowest band. And the a product of these three determinants is the variational wave function. We can do also do a gauge theory, which projects down into the physical Hilbert space to deduce the number of one-dimensional modes in this state for the D-wave metal on the two-leg ladder. And the number of modes is the number of modes in mean field theory, which is number of gapless modes, 1, 2, 3, and then for spin, 4, 5, minus the number of gauge constraints, which is 2. So we have and predict, in fact, that it should be 3 gapless modes in this D-wave metal that is a central charge of C equals 3. So this is, you know, a very strongly entangled many-body state. But that's what the state is. How does it compare to the DMRG data where we actually solved the Hamiltonian? Well, let's focus on the electron momentum distribution function and see if we can understand that those funny shapes that we saw in the electron momentum distribution function. Well, in mean field theory, because of this product of these three fermions, the electron momentum distribution function is a convolution of the dx, dy, and spinon momentum distribution functions. Now, the gauge theory will go beyond mean field theory, and will enhance certain wave vectors. But let me illustrate that with the boson ring model. So for the boson ring model, we just have a boson written as a product of two fermions, and then the boson momentum distribution function in mean field theory will be a convolution of the momentum distribution function for dx and the momentum distribution function for dy. But when we look at the DMRG solution of this boson ring model, what one finds is that there are very sharp peaks in the momentum distribution function, which look very different than this convolution. So if one performs this convolution, one doesn't get sharp peaks at all. So the Gutzwiller projection or the gauge projection changes the momentum distribution function very dramatically, and in this boson case gives these sharp peaks. But what we can do now is use the boson momentum distribution function and feed it in and convolve it with a spinon momentum distribution function to see if we can account for the electron momentum distribution function. And so to do that, just to be, you know, very heuristic, I'm going to replace the boson momentum distribution function with a set of delta functions in B tilde. And then I will convolve that boson momentum distribution function with the spinon momentum distribution function to get an approximation for the electron momentum distribution function. Okay, so once again, we're convolving the boson momentum distribution function with the spinon Fermi C. You know, this is just the filled Fermi C for spinless spinons, for spinful spinons, excuse me. You do this convolution, and what you get is given here on the bottom. So for the electron momentum distribution function at ky equals 0, one gets something that looks like this. For the electron momentum distribution function at ky equals pi, one gets something that looks like this. So these caricatures are really very suggestive of what one is finding in the DMRG, where one has this sort of square-shaped peak in the ky equals 0 momentum distribution function and this minima in the ky equals pi momentum distribution function.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, good. I'll be done with that. So what am I doing here? Okay, so we feel like that the parton construction and the gauge theory projection are giving us a pretty good description of this solution of this Hamiltonian with DMRG. We can look at other things. We can look at the density-density structure factor, and one sees singular features at particular momenta. And one can understand those within the parton construction as 2kF excitations in the various bands in this parton construction. And in particular, certain singularities, 2kF singularities, are enhanced by the gauge theory, and we can see that they coincide with the singularities that occur in the density-density structure factor. And finally, my graduate student Matt Block has done some very nice variation of Monte Carlo, which we can then compare with the DMRG directly. So the wave function is just this for the D-wave metal, a product of four determinants. And the variational parameters are basically just the distribution of the DX partons between the bonding and antibonding bands. And then he has two parameters to tune the Luttinger exponents, which he doesn't need, but improves the fitting. And then basically uses this variational wave function to minimize the energy of this TK ring Hamiltonian to choose the best variational parameters, and then can calculate correlation functions using variation of Monte Carlo and compare it to the DMRG. So here's just the energy of DMRG versus VMC. And basically the three states, one finds behavior consistent with that. There's not perfect agreement in the energy, but it's an upper bound, which is certainly a good thing, to the exact energy here from the DMRG. But one has the three phases, Luttinger liquid, spin polarized, and this D-wave metal. One can look at some of the electron momentum distribution functions in the coming from VMC, and they have indeed this very strange behavior, which we now understand from the parton construction. And as we vary parameters in the Hamiltonian, they evolve something like this. And where it ends up, when we have very large ring exchange term and the chains are almost decoupled, we get an electron momentum distribution function which looks something like this, you know, which is just totally bizarre. Both bonding and antibonding bands have the same electron momentum distribution function, and the only singularity is that Qx equals zero. Okay, and we can then, you know, try to compare directly VMC versus DMRG, looking at the electron momentum distribution function, which aren't perfect agreement, but the main features are there. And we can look at comparisons between VMC and DMRG for the density-density structure factor and the spin-spin structure factor, which compare rather nicely. Okay, so let me just wrap up very briefly. On the one hand, I think we've been successful because we've been trying to find a Hamiltonian which we can solve, which will exhibit a non-Fermi liquid two-dimensional itinerant electron. That's, you know, that's really been the goal. And to try to understand that non-Fermi liquid state in some simple way. So here what we've done is started with this parton construction. We've had this all fermionic decomposition of the electron, and then the variational wave function has the product of the four determinants. And we were able to construct a Hamiltonian, which, you know, while looking a little bit complicated, was not so far from, you know, the type of reasonable Hamiltonians might actually be thinking about in the context of solid-state physics. And then solutions with DMRG of that Hamiltonian on the two-leg ladder are indeed revealing evidence for this D-wave metal phase, which whose properties coincide, you know, rather nicely with the parton construction for the D-wave metal. And we thereby have some intuition for what's actually going on in this very strongly entangled electronic state. But this, you know, is very much type of work with it which is in its infancy, and when we really like to have, you know, better approaches, other wave functions, other Hamiltonians, which one could study for non-Fermi liquid phases. And I think, okay, with that, I'll thank you guys, thank Mike. Thank you, right.
You get all the, probably all the wave.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, I mean, what one can do, I mean, using the VMC, well, first of all, using the DMRG, one could go to three legs and four legs and try to see whether that intuition is correct. Using VMC, one could actually work right in two dimensions and look at the energetics of a correlated Fermi liquid versus a D-wave metal versus a BCS D-wave superconductor. And versus a spin polarized state, but I think that is an artifact of the two leg ladder. Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks.
Okay, so I think now we should go. go to the coffee break. We'll come back at 11 o'clock.